This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on October 26, 2011. Tonight we're talking to serial guest Jeff Atwood, and tonight we're talking about just games and computers and all that. And Jeff, when I was talking to you about this beforehand, one interesting thing that you were mentioning was, you know, the whole kind of crossover of computer games and programming and how they're kind of interrelated.
Yeah, that's right. And starting with, I mean, a lot of programmers, not all programmers, but a lot of programmers got their start with games. And the example I give is my dad. I wanted the latest, greatest console, which at the time was like the Atari 2600 or Intellivision. I think it was the Intellivision, actually, that I wanted and couldn't get. And rather than get me the Intellivision, my dad said, no, we'll get you a computer, and then you can, you know, learn how to write games on the computer and maybe play games on the computer. And that was sort of my introduction to that world of programming, was seeing a game and thinking, you know, how do I change this game? How would I even create a game like this? Because games back then, too, were a lot simpler. I think now it's tough looking at a really advanced high-end game and thinking, how would you even begin to create all the stuff it takes to make a game? But back in 1983, when, you know, a guy is like a series of 5 pixels, it's not too hard to think, oh, I could draw those 5 pixels. I could make a guy look like he's running. You know what I mean? So maybe it's harder now. But back then, it just seemed like the crossing the chasm of playing games to writing a game was not really such a big ask. Although there was still the dichotomy, like people who wrote games in like assembly language, that was still very much a thing in the 80s and probably still is in some quarters. They were doing things like in My Little Basic games that I could only dream of. Like there was this whole list of techniques. It's like, wow, how did they do that? And it was like, step one, learn assembly language. Step two, write directly to the video registers. And like, I was like, okay, I tapped out, right? I can't do that. But that's the process. And this idea that you can have a world and then control the world by these set of rules is, I think, a mindset that's very compatible with becoming a programmer. So I think just mentally, this idea that you would obsess over a game, learn all the rules, have a spreadsheet describing the rules, want to document it in a wiki, that's extremely programmery, right? So there's a lot of overlap there. Not completely, but I think it's a very strong tendency in a lot of programmers.
This is interesting. We had a conversation with Sarah Chips, a follow-up on her Girl Develop It program. And, you know, we were talking about just cultural differences between boys and girls growing up and like boys, you know, just in general playing more computer games. And then the idea that games are like just completely unmerciful and completely logical in that they, you know, follow a set of steps. And if you don't do the right things, you are not going to finish Tomb Raider. Like, it's just not going to happen, you know? And so I noticed that, like, I've been teaching my daughter JavaScript lately. And, you know, just the thing of like, oh, really? I have to, like, if I leave that parentheses off, it just doesn't work. Like, it just, it's different, you know, it's a different mindset, I think.
Yeah, the hard failure of like, if you do the slightest thing wrong, it's just utter and complete failure, which doesn't really jibe with life. You know, in life, there's a lot of things you can do partially that kind of work. And computers and programming are just so unlike that. And I think learning to love very arbitrary rule systems. In fact, if you remember the blog entry a long time ago, programming sheep and programming sheep and non-programming goats or vice versa. I can't remember the animals, but one of the rules that they found was that the people who could deal with completely arbitrary rule systems and learn to embrace just completely made up rules did really, really well in programming. And the people who couldn't, they were like, well, why does this rule exist? This doesn't make sense. Why would it behave this way? You have to accept that almost immediately, that there's this completely arbitrary set of rules you're going to use to create something. And, you know, whether you enjoy that or not depends on, you know, whether you're going to be able to be a programmer or not, ultimately. I thought that was a really interesting finding from that.
That is funny, that, and it reminds me of a post I read just this earlier this week about a study where they compared, what was it, programmer success using, and they introduced people who hadn't programmed in anything, and they had 3 languages, one being one that was kind of adapted to how people used it, another was Perl, and another was, it was like Randomo or something, but it had a randomized, like the syntax was completely arbitrary, like designed to be arbitrary. And they said that people were, I think, more effective with the arbitrarily random language than they were with Perl.
I saw that. I didn't get a chance to read I saw a reference to that on Twitter.
Yeah, that was funny. Well, so did you ever create any games yourself?
I did. I created so many crappy games that sucked totally. But, like, I love them. Actually, one of my greatest accomplishments in high school, well, actually, no, this is middle school. This is even before high school, was I actually wrote a game that people in my class, like, enjoyed playing. And I was like, wow. You know, that was really cool because I wrote it to be fun and I wrote it sort of for me, but it was just a neat sign that you could create something that you liked that other people also liked. That was in a very, very small way. I mean, we're talking like five kids that were actually liked computers and were willing to boot up the Apple II and put this disc in and play my little stupid game that I made. So I did create at least one game that someone liked and then a bunch of crappy games that basically I only played. But, you know, I had fun. I mean, to me, that was the point. My dad was completely right. He was like, rather than play the game, this is sort of the issue with games is they're entertainment. There's nothing wrong with entertainment. But and then hopefully we'll get into this, Kevin, with Rocksmith. You know, when you finish playing, what do you have to show for the time you spent in that game? What's the net result of that game? What has changed in your life? What has changed in the world as a result of you playing that game? And for a lot of games, it's just purely entertainment. There's nothing wrong with that. It's like going to see a movie. But I really like this concept of the games where you play them and they sort of change you a little bit for the better. Like you learn something or you develop some actual skill that's useful not just in the game but also outside the game in some way. Those are the best kind of games, I think, and the ones that interest me the most.
Speaking of Rocksmith, I mean, I've been really interested in that, and I'm really happy to see it. I know we talked about this before, but when we worked together, and I really was excited about trying to play Rock Band, and I just could not do it because I was trying to play music, and it really, to me, is more like Dance Dance Revolution. Like, you're doing something along with, in time with the music on something that looks like a guitar or drums, but, like, if you try and play them as instruments... Maybe it was just me. It's probably just me. But I was just confused. Like, I was surprised when playing the drums on Rock Band that, like, one pad would change between the snare and a tom, you know, during the song. And I'm like, I was like, even the drums aren't drums, you know? And so I think, as I understand it, the deal with Rocksmith is you're actually, like, playing a guitar and it's listening to you and you walk away, like, able to play some guitar.
That's right. I'll let Kevin take it away. I'm just give a little tiny intro to Rocksmith because Kevin's probably honestly been playing it more than I have, hopefully, because I've been playing Battlefield 3 for the most part. But the cool thing about Rocksmith is that it is indeed an analog. It's listening to what you're doing by the guitar's analog outport and sensing whether you're playing the correct notes for a particular point in the song. So the instrument, if you will, is not a fake plastic guitar, but it's a real guitar. It's a real electric guitar that you could just pick up, you know, in your house or from Guitar Center or whatever and plug it in, and it teaches you sort of the basics and sort of walks you through the list. But I want to, in defense of Rock Band, one of the things you learn when you start taking on like Pro Guitar in Rock Band 3, which is a real guitar, or in Rocksmith, is that playing guitar is really frigging hard. Like, I mean, off the charts hard. Like, if there was a, you know how most games have a difficulty. It's like, okay, do you want to play easy? Do you want to play medium? Do you want to play hard? Do you want to play expert? Well, a real guitar, if you actually had a linear scale of difficulty, would be like difficulty level 100. Like, you'd have to scroll down beyond expert to, like, you know, 100 items down in the list. It's impossibly hard. The button-based controller that they use for Rock Band 3, there's two controllers you can use to play pro guitar. One is more of a plastic guitar, but it has literally like 118 buttons. So you're going from a 5-button plastic guitar, which is the simplified anyone can do it version of guitar that's not really accurate, as you point out. Like, it's completely inaccurate. In fact, it's just made up nomenclature for how to play music. When you transfer to the real, the guitar that's actually simulating the right finger positions, not 5 buttons, it's actually 118 buttons, mm-hmm, and 6 strings, right, on top of that. So it's just this, you drive off a cliff of difficulty. And that's why you have to start, you know, total baby steps, like just really, really newbie stuff. And it's still enjoyable, but I just want to defend Rock Band a little. Like, if you tried to show someone, like, Rocksmith... it's not really fun like Rock Band is. It's fun in the sense that it's rewarding and it's work and you have to practice that and keep trying at it. But it's not like, hey, let's go have a 15-minute jam session and just, you know, pretend we're rock stars.
Yeah.
We're going to go in a room and work for 15 minutes. It's just a very different experience. It's not necessarily wrong, but it's different. So, Kevin, you want to take it away and talk about your experience with the game so far?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's, you know, Rock Band can be played casually. You can get a bunch of people together and who have never played before, and they can kind of do something with it. And Rocksmith is so not that. I mean, it is, you're right, it is absolutely work.
it's almost actually the opposite of that. I mean, it's like, yes, we're not going to have fun, right? We're going to go into a room. We're going to choose not to have fun for a long, and for a long time, like months. It's like,
but I have to say, I mean, I don't get me wrong. I think it's a lot of fun, and I've been having a ton of fun playing it. But it is not easy. You have to want to learn to play guitar in order to play this game. You know, it's not something you do as a moment, you know, as a little diversion. But I've kind of always wanted to play guitar, and I've had an acoustic guitar for years that kind of sat in the closet gathering dust, and, you know, I could play five chords and, you know, whatever. And so it was something I always wanted to learn how to play guitar, and this came up, and it was just the perfect, I mean, it was such the perfect opportunity for me that I bought an Xbox, which I didn't own. I bought an electric guitar, which I didn't own. And then I bought this game just so I could, you know, experience it.
And unfortunately, this will be disappointing to John. It does not do bass guitar. There's some... I actually got a little preview of the game. Ubisoft has an office where they actually developed the game in San Francisco, or at least a large part of it. And one of the questions that came up a lot was, well, what about bass guitar? And there's two things about that. One is you'd have to buy a bass guitar, first of all. This is like a real guitar game. So like having a guitar doesn't help you play bass. You need a bass guitar. So it's yet another $200 or at least $120 instrument, right? And then the other thing, it's rumored that bass notes, because they vibrate at a lower frequency, are a little bit more difficult to detect reliably than guitar notes, which tend to be higher. I don't know if there's any truth to that or not. What they said to me was that they were thinking about doing a bass guitar sort of as a DLC add-on to the game for people who wanted to do it. They could buy like a $10 add-on that would unlock bass for all the existing songs in the game. Because, John, you play primarily bass, right? Is that true?
Yeah, it is. And that does make sense to me. Lower notes have more higher overtones, and so it gets really muddled, and it's harder to... That's why, like, you can bang around on higher keys on a piano, and it's less likely to sound horrible. But if you play it on lower keys, the overtones are going to just collide a lot more. But so when you're playing Rocksmith, are you playing single notes at a time, or you know, single... Or are you playing chords?
You can do both.
Oh.
So the songs you can pick when you're playing your songs, not necessarily all songs, but a lot of the songs you can pick chord, single note, or some songs have combinations. So it's a mix of the two.
That's just amazing to me. Like, just like everything, but technology moving along so far, because I played with MIDI triggers for bass and guitar a long time ago, and it was just not at all there. Like, I just played with it in the store, you know, I was like, this is just not even useful. And that was on single notes even sometimes, and chords was out of the question. So it's just amazing now that it's accurately picking stuff up. Is it accurate enough that, I mean, do you ever get upset and say, I played that right, why aren't you detecting it?
Yeah, I have had a few problems. There's the game has got these mini games in it. You know, there's these little like training games. So the first one you unlock is Duck Hunt or something like that. It's basically like it's a fret positioning game where you there's a bunch of columns, sort of like a Space Invaders kind of thing. And to move your gun, you slide up and down the frets, and then you pluck to fire your gun. And at least once I was sitting there like strumming the right fret and it was not picking it up. But it's not something that happens all the time. It's, you know, once or twice I've had that experience. So it's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect, but it's really, really good. Much better than I probably would have even expected. One thing I'd be curious about, Jeff, I've never played Pro Mode Rocksmith with the real guitar. And I was hesitant, you know, going back and forth on which one I wanted to get. What is your experience and the difference between the two?
The Rock Band 3 Pro Mode is, first of all, a little daunting to even get the right stuff for. There's two controllers, one of which is a hybrid real guitar. The other is a traditional controller type guitar with, as the aforementioned, 118 buttons. I might be off a little bit on that number, but it's over 100. And the six strings. So you have to get one of those controllers. And the other controller was actually discontinued, unfortunately. So there's apparently still stock, but it's the Fender Squire. But it's developed with special sensing technology in the neck, so they can actually tell where your fingers are and sort of very, very accurately. Whereas Rocksmith is just listening to, you know, it's trying to guess what notes you're playing by detecting the audio and analyzing it and so forth. This is actually operating more accurately based on your actual finger positions. So it's a more accurate technology. But I think what I found when I play Rocksmith was the guitar is not really about accuracy. I mean, you're supposed to play, I mean, correct me at any point, John, because I am not a musician, but the impression I got was that when say the Rolling Stones go on stage and play I Got Satisfaction, it never comes out the same way twice, does it? I mean, it's not like they're playing like a robot, you know?
No, definitely. And, you know, like, even if you're, I mean, and actually K. Scott is, I think, more of a musician than I am, definitely. But
oh, awesome. I didn't know that.
So, K. Scott, what all do you play?
Well,
kazoo,
trumpet, drums, and I have an electric guitar and some keyboards, but I pretty much play them all badly.
Wait, and also, you play
what are you best at? What's your best instrument? What's your most plausible instrument to play on?
Trumpet, actually. Trumpet's the only instrument that people have paid me to play.
I don't know the wind instruments at all, so that I can't relate to that, unfortunately. I know that drums is supposed to be one of the closest analogs because, now, John, you were talking earlier about the mixture of cymbals and pads, which they actually did fix in pro mode in Rock Band 3. A cymbal add-on, which is not expensive, so you end up with four pads, a pedal, and three cymbals, which is a fairly reasonable number of surfaces to hit to simulate like a basic drum kit.
Yeah.
So you're not mixing too much at that point. And the party line was that drumming, once you add the cymbals in Rock Band, is not that far apart from actually playing the drums. And I think there is some credibility to that, although I posted a question on Music Stack Exchange about this because I was trying to figure out, I got a fancier, more like a real electronic drum kit kind of to play with Rock Band, with like an actual pedal that hits a surface and stuff. And I was trying to figure out, like, how do you arrange the drums? Like, what's the typical arrangement of drums? And I learned stuff about, and again, this is games teaching me stuff, right? Like, I'm playing the game, but I'm also figuring out, like, okay, how is this supposed to work in the real world? You know, it's bleeding over now. It's like, if I was a real drummer, how would I arrange these pads? Because I can now arrange them in all these crazy different ways. I'm not limited to, I bought this drum set, you know, this plastic drum set, and it comes in this fixed arrangement. A real drum set is a bunch of, you know, disconnected stuff that you sit down and you arrange in your particular, and every drummer is a little bit different, right? Some drummers are crazy, and I saw some YouTube video of the drummer from, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of the band. Oh, it's going to kill me that I can't remember this. But his drum kit takes like hours to assemble. It's like this incredible array of like dozens of cymbals, dozens of pads, dozens of toms, and
that God knows how like many Neil foot Peart. Pedals.
Yeah. Yeah, or like guys like that.
Rush,
you learn that there is no like exact correct way to play drums. And that's sort of my reaction to the guitar, was like the detection of the actual finger position seems at some level kind of at odds with the, I don't know, interpretive nature of musical performance, where you're not really playing it the same way every time. It's similar. It's very, very similar every time because you recognize it. You can hear it and say, oh, that's the same song I heard from their album. But it doesn't have to match. They can be off a little bit. They're going to miss one or two notes and you'll never hear it. They might. I mean, but that's one thing that really struck me about Rocksmith, was the analog detection was imprecise. It works, to be clear. It totally works. But it doesn't really need to be precise, because that's kind of not what the musical performance is about.
Right.
You know, this idea that you want that's perfect true. Accuracy is just kind of a weird direction to go in. And I'm kind of surprised, playing Rocksmith, that Harmonix, I have a lot of respect for, and they're all musicians. Like, almost everybody at Harmonix is an actual musician. So they have real credibility in terms of, they're not just building a game, they're building, you know, a musical, you know, toy at some level. It's a toy, but also a tool for learning to hear music. Like, rather than listening to the music on your iPod passively, you can play with it. And although you're not really playing guitar, you can sort of learn the rhythms. And you can you start to hear each track. You hear, okay, this is the drums, this is the guitar, this is the bass guitar. Like, I'm ashamed to admit, like, before playing Rock Band, like, I didn't know like kind of what was a cymbal and what was a drum, like, in the music. But now I hear it. I hear, okay, that's a cymbal hit, you know, that's a tom hit, that's a kick drum. I can actually tell, and to me, this is good. This is progress. This is like, I learned something. The game taught me something. And I can hear guitar. Obviously, I think most people can hear guitar. That's why there's Guitar Hero. But I could hear the bass line. You know, I was like, okay, that's the bass line. That's the bass guitar. And I've also started paying more attention to keyboard now that Rock Band 3 has keyboards. Like, I can sort of distinguish the keyboard, which tends to blend in a lot of songs. Like, there's a lot of songs that have keyboard that you don't really hear it, you know, unless you're, I guess, a musician, or like your ears are tuned to it. But the keyboard's kind of used for flavor in the song. There's a lot of songs like I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Did you know that has keyboard in it?
I can't think of it
often. Everybody knows this song.
Yeah.
Right? But there's keyboard in that song, but it's subtle, right? It's really subtle. And it's cool because after playing keyboard, you know, in the song, you can sort of start to pick it out from the oral mixture that is the song. It's like, oh, there's a little keyboard flavor that they added. Because, you know, there's a lot of synth songs like, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen or whatever. But in a lot of rock songs, they use synth for flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear it, but it's not, you know, in your face. But I loved being able to just explain that. Even to Henry, my son, he loves to go out there and bang on the drums. And when we hear songs, I go, listen, hear the guitar. Do you hear the piano? Do you hear, you know, you're breaking it apart, you know, and hearing all the individual parts that make up the song. And to me, that's fun. You know, I enjoy that. I just like to understand the music. It helps me appreciate it. Even if I'm just like, ultimately, I'm not performing the song. Obviously, I'm not going to go on stage and play I Love Rock and Roll with any semblance of credibility or dignity even. But just being able to listen to the song and appreciate it for the, you know, all the work that went into it and the things that make it what it is I think a worthwhile experience. So even if you don't go down the Rocksmiths, like, you know, pro guitar modes, I think it's still a useful exercise to learn to appreciate music more. Whereas I remember, John, you were kind of down on it. You were like kind of anti.
You know, maybe I think I was mostly just frustrated because I was thinking like, well, I should be able to, like, if I've played bass for, you know, so many years, I should be able to, you know, at least pass a song, you know? And then I was like, you know, I really, like, it's, and then, you know, I was frustrated by some of those things too. Like, music is not, there's, things aren't always, like, directly on the beats, you know? And things are, you know, and so it's like, if I was trying to play by what I heard, rather than looking at the moving colors on the screen, like, it was not, you know, so I would try and play based on instinct, and those instincts didn't work.
Totally get that. That makes sense, because that's just an expectations issue of, I had no expectations because I'm basically illiterate. I love music, but like, I have no musical ability whatsoever. So I had no expectations coming in, but certainly it would definitely be frustrating. And the other, one other cool thing about Rocksmith is, say you actually know a song and you're playing it on guitar in Rocksmith. Well, you're not really penalized for playing extra notes that are actually in the song, but not in the notation.
Yeah,
it's just listening. So as long as you get, because it starts you out on like uber beginner mode, it has the scaling difficulty thing, but you can just play the whole song and it'll see that you're hitting, you know, every fifth note that the beginner would make, and then it jumps you up to intermediate and it jumps you up to expert. But you're not getting penalized for playing those extra notes at any time. You can just kind of noodle and play the song.
And Rocksmith is just guitar right now, right?
Yeah, purely guitar. You can sing along. There's like a vocal thing, which I actually was doing when Betsy and I were messing around. She was playing, and I would just sing because I was actually a little bored. I was like, oh, I'm just going to sing because I got nothing else to do except watch you play guitar. And it's fun. It's just a way to pass the time, but you're not really scored on that. And yeah, there's no bass or anything like that.
Right. So, but, John, did you ever do Rock Band?
You know, I tried Rock Band, and I thought I was – I tried other instruments, and I think for me it was a hang – like playing bass, mostly it's a weird instrument because it ties rhythm and the melody together. And so like, I'm like hyper fixated on things that would not at all, like just completely conflicted with it, you know? So like the timing threw me off on the musical things. And then on the drums, I was like, okay, well I can keep a beat, and I close my eyes and start playing. And then I'm like, look up and I'm like, rah, rah, you know? So, but I know a lot of other musicians that love Rock Band and did great at it. And my older brother has a music studio. They do advertising music, and they had a lot of composers on staff that would play Rock Band. And the drummers, most of these, all the composers are, you know, musicians that are working a day job, you know, making music to support their music habit. But the drummers did great at this stuff. They're because it's all rhythm based, you know, and they were able to like, okay, you know. So how about you?
I love it for parties and things like that, but I could never get into it, sort of like trying to get better at it, or, you know, buying the game and playing it at home. I couldn't get into that.
Well, I see where you're coming from, because I think, you know, the original Guitar Hero came out in, gosh, 2005. And there's a certain amount of fatigue that sets in. First, it's a novelty. It's like, wow, we're playing a game that lets us pretend to play guitar, and that's really cool. And you spend a year or two sort of being infatuated with the concept. But then, you know, 5-6 years on, it's like you're still playing 5 colored buttons. It's like, well, why do I need to be good at this? You know, what's the point? I'm enjoying the song.
Right.
I can hear the guitar. I've gotten to a certain skill level where I can pass most songs. But what's the return to me of spending hours and hours of getting like hyper good, where I could complete every song at expert on 100%? These people are out there, man. I mean, go to YouTube and you'll see, you know, anything you can do. You're utterly outclassed with the audience of the world on YouTube. But with something like Rocksmith, the cool thing is, okay, this is incredibly difficult. Like I said, if there's 4 difficulty levels, imagine there was 100 difficulty levels, and this is at the very bottom at the maximum. But just sucking at it is rewarding. Like, just sucking at it and playing like the Black Keys' I Got Mine, which is, I think, the second song in the game. The first is I Can't Get No Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. And the second is Black Keys, which is a very simple guitar song. And just the idea that you're hitting these simplified, you know, one note versions of the song. And when I say one note, if you don't know guitar, and everybody, you guys do, but just for the benefit of our listeners, so you got six strings, and then you have fret positions from 1 to, I think, 22. So you got to be on the right string and possibly multiple fingers on the right strings. But in the simple case I'm describing, all you have to do, put your finger on the correct string from 1 to 6 in the correct numbered position from 1 to 22. This is really, really hard. Even, and that's like the most simple version of guitar there is, right? Single notes, mm-hmm. like single string, single notes. No chords, no nothing. Just strum the right string on the right numbered position. Just doing that correctly for four different notes in a row, when you're a real beginner, it feels like, wow, I've really accomplished something. You know, I've actually learned to do this incredibly difficult thing in a very, very simplified way. But you could see yourself spending, you know, months and months learning to actually play all the chords. And, you know, at the end of that road, you have actual guitar skills, right? You have something to show for the 100+ hours that you sunk into, you know, becoming an expert guitarist in Rock Band you might not have so much of. Did you guys remember the South Park episode about Rock Band where they're auditioning a pro, you know, guitar hero guitarist, and the guy's like, show me what you can do. So he breaks out, he just starts playing air guitar with the buttons, like in the air. He's not actually playing guitar, he's just like doing the finger movements, and all the people, he's in a restaurant or something, there's like people around, and they're all like clapping, they're like, I love this song. You know, it's like he's playing it so accurately with the five buttons that, you know, he's actually, you know, I know what this is, Freebird or whatever. It just pointing out the absurdity of becoming really, really good at this. It's like you haven't mastered anything that matters. I mean, you had fun, which is great, but you don't really have anything to show for that time that, mm-hmm. that you spent on entertainment. And I think that's the next great frontier. And if on my blog, I wrote a blog entry about what they call gamification, which is this idea of taking things that are really, really hard to do, like playing guitar, which is really freaking hard, and making it fun by throwing these game-like elements at it, rather than starting with the premise of, let's make a game that absorbs your free time so you're not bored in your life. Why not start with the premise of, we have this thing to do that people like. People like guitar. People like to play guitar. But it's really freaking hard, so almost nobody learns how to do it. Let's take that and somehow turn that into more of a game so more people are inclined to actually start doing it. And that was kind of the way I always really saw Rock Band. I kind of had this idea in the back of my mind that eventually, somehow, I didn't know how, back in 2005, this would equate to me learning more about music and not becoming so musically illiterate on every instrument there is. And we're sort of seeing that come to fruition now, which I think is very exciting.
Well, and like you pointed out, though, already the appreciation side of it, being able to tease apart the different instruments and what's playing now and how they fit together and all that, is, like you're saying, it's getting involved in the music rather than just being like a consumer of it. And I think that's a huge step, like you're saying.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, just the fact that you went out and looked for how to set up a set of drums.
Well, pretty yeah, cool. Because this, you know, if you buy the traditional drums have a very fixed arrangement and you just get used to that fixed arrangement. But once I had flexibility with to be clear, this is a very crappy entry level electronic drum kit, but a real drummer arranges their drums however they see fit, you know, and that's interesting to me. And I didn't realize I had that freedom, but yeah. So, but I think that's the road that we're on here with this stuff.
So is this the future of music education? I mean, is this going to be how we teach our children to play music?
I don't know, but I want to see a lot more games like this. One of the reasons I actually, on our Stack Exchange podcast, I'm kind of always bad-mouthing our gaming site, which I feel bad about because I love video games. But for most video games, like if I become an expert Battlefield 3 player, that doesn't mean anything. Like I haven't really, I'm just throwing time away at some level. And it's okay because not everybody has to spend every hour. The fallacy is every hour of every day must be spent finding a cure for cancer. And every hour that we're not spending finding a cure for cancer, we're actively advancing the cause of cancer, right? Like this is the wrong way to look at the world. It's not a zero sum game where everybody must spend every waking moment doing something productive. This is, I think, a poisonous attitude to take in life. But on the other hand, it is difficult to look at spending. Like I spent 250 hours playing Battlefield 2 Bad Company. And, you know, I look back, I had fun, but wouldn't it be awesome if I had taken those 250 hours and been, I don't know, you know, learning guitar? Like, how good would I be at guitar if I had played Rocksmith for 250 hours? It's just kind of neat to think that I would like more and more games to have this connection with the real world where you can play the game, you'll have fun, but you'll also get this other ancillary benefit out of it. So mm-hmm. when you spend 100, 200, 300, who knows, thousands of hours playing this, at the end of that road, you have this thing to show for it that makes you better at something in your life that you actually give a crap about. Now, the argument for World of Warcraft, I had a really old blog entry about this, was World of Warcraft was really about teamwork. So the more time you spent in World of Warcraft, you became very good at coordinating with others on the internet to solve some, you know, arbitrary RPG-based problem. I'm not totally convinced this is not bullshit, by the way.
Is this a part like, where I yell out Leroy Jenkins?
Yes, and the guy that was saying this was Joy Ito, who's a fairly notable internet mm-hmm. personality. I don't know if he even plays World of Warcraft anymore, but I have friends that still play World of Warcraft. And we used to give Nick Craver, who's a developer on the Stack Exchange team now, he's very, very good. We used to give him crap about he was playing World of Warcraft a lot. And Jared Dixon, his friend, who was one of the original programmers on Stack Overflow, and that's how I sort of knew Nick was through him, was always sort of hassling him about this and saying, if you just spent as much time on Stack Overflow as you did on World of Warcraft, you know, you'd have something to show for it. And the weird thing about it is that he was kind of right, because for whatever reason, Nick, later in the life of Stack Overflow, just got really into Stack Overflow kind of as a game a little bit. And he was out repping like John Skeet for a long time. Not anymore, because once we hire you, we take up all your time and you don't have time to go on Stack Overflow anymore. Which is a sad commentary on, you know, how Stack Overflow was built from the time of programmers who are really underemployed in a lot of ways. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think it's actually a negative, because they're spending time doing things that are making them better as programmers. And it's hard to argue that that's a waste of time in a way that, say, World of Warcraft might be. So even if you are playing it as a game, we're giving you something back for that. You know, you become a better communicator, you become a better programmer, you learn how to solve problems, you learn how to communicate. These are things that are going to help you make more money, you know, have a more enriching and rewarding career. And I get really excited. And we also had the guy from Extra Credits, which is a gaming animated show that's now on Penny Arcade. And they've been doing, it's really, really thoughtful, really interesting stuff. And he's had a number of shows about like the gamification of education, you know, how achievements sort of incentivize you to do the things that you really should do, but maybe aren't engaged enough to do. They just sort of give you that little push that sometimes helps you do the right thing. And that's sort of the design ethic of you know, when we looked at Stack Overflow and the Stack Exchange Engine, is like, this is stuff you should normally do anyway. We're not making you do anything. Like, you know how hypnosis, they say you can't hypnotize someone to do something they wouldn't normally do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, shoot their spouse or something crazy like that. Like, they just wouldn't do it. So hypnosis is really just the process of suggesting things that were kind of already on your mind already and just giving you that extra push and getting you over the hump and getting it done. But to end that very long-winded rant, I wish more and more games would focus on the real-world problem first and then add the entertainment to it. And it's a hybrid. You're still going to have fun. This isn't about, you know, work, work, work. But just don't start with the premise of let's absorb free time. Start with the premise of there's this really hard problem of getting people to work together in the world. And, you know, now we have the internet. We have all these other new exciting ways to get people to work together. And I think the intersection of, you know, the internet, hard problems where people need to work together, and games is fascinating. I mean, I think there's a never-ending list of things you can do with it. And
or, like, maybe teach them how to farm.
Well, can we talk about, like, Khan Academy? Have you gone to Khan Academy recently?
It's been a bit, but I just read a huge article on that on and I think it was Wired or something. It's fascinating. It's a huge amount of content, right?
But it's like scoring you. It's keeping track. Like, you have a rank, you know, based on how many exercises you've done, and there's this whole gamification angle that they're sort of aggressively pursuing. Because when you're when you're dealing with kids and you're teaching them, you know, something they may or may not be interested in, I do think it's fair to approach that as, well, why can't this be fun? You know, what's preventing this from being fun and enjoyable? And what could we add to this to make it more interesting and enjoyable? And I think going, if you go to Khan Academy, you'll see some of the levels and rep and, you know, things that they've added to encourage students to, you know, keep trying, keep learning. I think that's a great way to go. And then, John, did you want to talk about the stuff you're doing with your daughter? I think is fascinating. That's the that JavaScript site that I was very impressed with.
Yeah, actually, that's what I was just gonna say. It's Codecademy. It's not Code Academy. It's CodeCademy.com. And the things I like about it, one, it's interactive. So it's telling you to do something and you're typing it on the screen. You know, it's like a REPL in C or in JavaScript. And it gives, you know, very simple steps and you keep building up. And so a lot of successes quickly, easily. And if you get them wrong, you can see a hint and it'll help you through. And then the same kind of things, the gamification stuff. So you get badges and you get, you know, a lot of kind of, it's a lot of quick rewarding stuff. So she's been through the basic JavaScript lesson. And then I found another site, Repl.it, REPL.IT. And, you know, I gave her some little assignments. I said, you know, count from 10 to 20. And if the number is less than 16, say you are too young to drive. And if the number is over 16, say, congratulations, you can drive because you are, and then print the age. And, you know, she had to fight with the braces and semicolons and all that kind of stuff. But she was like so happy when she got it. She's like, can you believe, and going around telling everybody, I made the computer do this. And, you know, I taught the computer my name and it said it back to me. And it's, yeah. So I think what you're saying, like, you know, putting time into a game, you know, and this is clearly not really a game, but it tries to be, but it's more on the kind of work side of it, but then making it as rewarding as possible. You know, I mean, beating the level by, you know, getting the points and having the computer say your name is kind of cool.
So have you guys ever heard of Roblox?
Yes, there is a Stack Exchange Roblox site that's in proposal.
Oh, wow. Yeah, my youngest son got into this website sometime last year and came to me and asked if he could have a membership on it. I forget how much it was or what that even got him. But to me, it was just this multiplayer online game where people ran around with blocks and there's other people there. I'm not even sure what he did, but one day he had gotten really into it. One day he came to me and he said, do you know how to program with Lua? I was like, with what?
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, we looked at it and I mean, it's incredible. I was teaching him how to write some script. Actually, they have a Roblox Studio, which is the Visual Studio redistributable shell where you can build scripts for this world. So
Roblox maybe, is a huge thing.
Maybe a little more than what he should be starting with, but you know, it's at least showing him how to twiddle some things in existing scripts to make that's things awesome. Behave differently.
I think that's awesome. And I think kids, they should be, I mean, this is a general approach to learning, but you should always be taking on a little bit more than you can comfortably do, right?
Yep.
So I think that's a perfect way to look at this. It's like, oh, he's kind of outmatched here. It's like, that's good that you know, incentivizes him to keep attacking and solve it.
Exactly. Yeah.
But Roblox is a huge thing. And I still don't fully understand like what they're doing in Roblox. Like I've seen like my cousin is into this and he was very impressed. He was super impressed that the guy who built Roblox knew who I was, that like, he was like beyond impressed that because of Stack Overflow and stuff and the connection with the programming. But he was blown away by that. And from what little I've seen of him playing it, it's a lot like, I want to say Minecraft a little bit, where you're going in and you're sort of just arbitrarily constructing stuff in the world, just kind of for your general amusement and also to play with. I honestly don't know much more about it than that, but it seemed very constructive. It seemed like a good way to spend time, a good example of what we're talking about, where they're playing, but they're learning, you know, how to build things and, you know, how to construct things in this virtual world. And what the rules are, you know, again, and, right. That pesky rules word comes up again.
How to work with other people to some extent.
Yeah, and that's true. It's fully multiplayer. That's a great point. Like, you know, it's not just the single player thing of, you know, solve this problem and get through this gate. But like, how do I get these other people to help me do this thing that I want to do, which is often much more difficult than the actual construction of the device.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny that whole thing of like going beyond and getting involved, even if it's you're over your head. And that reminded me, my kids got way into World of Goo, enough so that they wanted like World of Goo pillows and my daughter wanted a World of Goo birthday party. And like,
wow.
Yeah. And she actually cried when she found out there was never going to be a World of Goo too. Like she was just heartbroken, but. But they all were like, so my two older daughters were just really into World of Goo and so, okay, there's no World of Goo too. But then I looked around and I found this goofans.com or something. And people had all these kind of new levels that they'd built. And it turned out that they'd released, I forget the guy's name, but he'd released something that was like, okay, you want to build your own levels, go for it. And and there's a Goo studio, and you can actually like open up World of Goo levels and just it, like you could build your own from scratch, but it's difficult. Like level building is not easy in any game that I've ever tried. And even in this, it was like, it was, you know, it's like, okay, you can get started and you can move things around, but to really build a level is tricky. But she built her own level and it kind of worked. And I mean, it was fun. I mean, it was just neat to see her do that. And I had to help her quite a bit, but you know, it was cool to kind of get beyond and be interactive with it.
Mm. Yeah. And speaking of being over your head, I had a Texas Instruments 99-4A that I used to type in basic programs for magazines on it for games, and then try to write some of my own games in Visual Basic. And somewhere I read that, you know, real games are written in assembly language. So actually, yes. I had my parents buy the TI-99-4A assembler for me, and I was trying to learn assembly programming.
Wow. You are hardcore.
And tear apart the Tombstone game. But the most interesting thing about all this, I guess I was in, I don't know, 8th grade, maybe 7th grade when this was going on. The biggest mind-opening experience I had was I knew enough about games to know that I needed some random numbers for my game to make things behave differently. And I'm looking at the assembly language instructions, and I don't see anything that generates a random number. And I spent, you know, this is before Google or anything like that. I literally spent days walking around. I remember just being obsessed with this, not paying attention to anything in school, thinking, how can a computer really generate a random number? Well, it can it? And finally, I got a hold of one of my sister's older friends who did some programming. I'm like, how do you really generate a random number with a computer? And he started talking about all these, you know, crazy math operations. And that was
That's a great topic. I mean, this is and this is on the podcast when we had the guy from Extra Credits on, James. The incidental learning, where you're playing a game, and the example he used was a game about history, like a World War II game, where you just become interested about the weapons of World War II, the cultures, like why World War II happened, things like that. But even outside history, I think that's a good example. History is kind of a softball. But games, just tearing apart something and trying to understand the concepts behind it is a great example of incidental learning that I think you get if you're doing this the right way. And games should be designed to encourage that. The example they used, I think, was embedding Wikipedia into the game in some places, where you could sort of say, click here to learn the actual background of this thing. You know, because I think learning should be like a random walk in some ways. Another thing he was proposing was, rather than a structured learning program, he said, go from point A to point B, play the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game on Wikipedia. How do you get from butterflies to the Tang Dynasty, right? And then you can just follow your own path, which people do anyway. You're on Wikipedia and you start clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking. And there's, of course, like everything else in life, there is an XKCD cartoon for this, people. I shouldn't have to explain this to you. Eventually, that we'll just stop talking. We'll just say, we'll just have numbers.
Yeah.
I now reference XKCD number 321, right?
We'll all laugh.
Yeah. Well, you're so right. But
it's like that. Did you ever see that Star Trek The Next Generation episode where there's like a whole culture... Game. Where there's a whole culture and all their communication is all based on references to their things that happened in the past of the culture. Did you guys ever see this?
No.
Mm-mm. Anyway, it's like our entire language will evolve to be just references to XKCD articles.
Yeah, well, I just get really frustrated by that because it comes up a lot on Stack Overflow and programmers. It's like within a community of programmers, it's super endemic.
Yeah.
It's like the first thing they reach for. And it's not bad. I mean, I love XKCD. He's really good. But we got to have more points of reference. Like, one of the things I get frustrated with in programmer culture is it's very insular. Like, you need to look outside XKCD for ways to explain things in the world. Because the world is full of really interesting stuff, and limiting yourself to XKCD is not good. I thought you were going to reference the Next Generation episode about the addictive video game. I remember Wesley Crusher started playing.
Oh, yes, I remember that one.
I thought that's what you were going to go for, the really addictive games, like the negative side of gamification, where you're getting incentivized to do things that are sort of bad for you or ultimately...
Yeah, I did actually want to ask about that, because it does seem like I'm no gamification expert, but it seems like it's sort of a psychology hack, you know, against the brain. Oh,
it totally is, but...
And it seems like that can be, you know, that's got a bad... can have a bad side, too.
Well, exactly. And the example that James Portnow brought up was the Monopoly game at McDonald's. You know, the Monopoly game they run every year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, that game is designed like you get the most pieces by buying the items at McDonald's that have the highest profit margin, which is the drinks and the French fries. So the game is sort of getting you to buy the stuff that they make the most profit on, which, you know, they're a business, right? I mean, I don't know if that's actually wrong. but in the hands of some like Zynga's, right?
Right.
You're not really learning anything by playing Farmville. That's the disappointing part. Is it takes a little bit of discipline around creating entertainment that reaches a little bit higher than the average entertainment. It's not designed to just tie you up and take money out of your wallet, but also to sort of tie you up and sort of put you in front of things that we as a culture, as people, need to understand and, you know, attack and figure out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are the hard problems and how can we help? And I think maybe at some level, just getting everybody a good education is kind of a hard problem. so that's maybe one place to start. That's why I think what the Khan Academy is doing. And one of the guys at Khan Academy is used to work at Fog Creek and follows Stack Exchange stuff very avidly, and I think is influencing a lot of stuff that they're doing there.
Yeah, I forget who else they hired recently. They've hired some pretty big names in software development. I think it was somebody from Mozilla or something.
Well, they hired John Resnick.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's a pretty big name.
Doesn't he do something with computers? I'll have to look that up. You know, and you were saying the negative side of things, and even just specifically with Farmville, I think that's very interesting with things like, you know, you assume you're just playing a game and not really, you know, like these things that are run as a business, you know, slot machines are run on specific margins to, you know, make you, you know, they're to extract money out of you. And even like, Kevin, you pointed me at that You Are Not So Smart blog, and there's a thing about Farmville in there. And it was interesting talking about how the social engineering makes you feel like, you know, the fear of loss, the fear of death of your crops makes you come back and makes you, you know,
Let me talk about loss aversion. I love if you research sort of how gamification, I always pronounce things wrong, so don't use me as an example for this. You start examining the human concepts behind it. And we went on a trip recently with Henry, and we found some temporary tattoos at the grocery store, and we got them for Henry. And we were putting them on, and at one point Henry started peeling off all the plastic covers from the tattoos. And I was like, well, no, Henry, leave the plastic covers on, because the tattoos will get damaged if, you know, just do the ones that we're actually going to put on your hand. And I put the plastic covers back on, but I put them on the wrong way. There was two sides. There was a smooth side and a rough side, and I put the rough side down. And when you do that, when you peel it off, it kind of ruins all the tattoos. And I ruined a whole page of tattoos, and it really bothered me. Like, I was like, wow, that sucked. Like, it bothered me to the point, like, I have to go back to the store and buy more of those tattoos because I feel like we ruined all these tattoos and now we'll never get to use these. And of course, it's stupid because there were 100 tattoos in that thing, right? Did it really matter if one sheet out of four was not available anymore?
Mm-hmm.
But it really bothered me, like this idea that I had something and now I no longer had it. Like it had been taken away from me in a kind of an arbitrary way. It was very traumatic, even for something stupid like that, that didn't even matter at all. And, you know, when you start thinking about things that do matter, like money and, you know, fame and power and, you know, just wow. I mean, imagine how powerful it could be, right?
I had a silly example of that that I realized, you know, I was on an air. I flew to India last year, and I had a really long trip, and I'd been meaning to buy some noise canceling headphones, and I just hadn't done it. And finally, I'm like, I got time to kill at the airport. I saw some and I splurged, and I spent $80 on some decent, but they were way overpriced, but I bought them there because they're at the airport. And then at the end of the trip, I left them on the airplane. And then after that, I wanted to buy some more noise canceling headphones, but I couldn't do it because I'd already spent the money and, you know, the whole kind of, I'd lost it. And finally I ended up buying some, and they were on a sale. So it all worked out for me. But it was just like, you know, that whole way that we treat losing something versus getting something is pretty bizarre.
Well, one book that I really liked for that, and I also blogged about this, the book 59 Seconds. It's a productivity book with a lot of science in it. And he covers a lot of this ground about like the ways you approach the world, like, you know, loss aversion, like how can you counteract loss aversion? Like how can you control your reaction to loss aversion, and sort of 1 minute exercises you can do every day. Just make sure you're aware of this so that when it happens, you can control it or at least be aware of it. So I do want to put in a plug for that book because that was an amazing book. I found it on our Skeptic site, and it covers a lot of the sort of the life hacky things about, you know, why we do stuff and how we feel about things, and that it isn't always rational and does tie into a lot of the gamification stuff. I think, you know, knowing is half the battle, as G.I. Joe used to say. As long as you know you're prone to do this stuff, you can then figure it out and tease it apart, even if sometimes you fall prey to it.
You know, go ahead, sorry.
Well, so there's the mind hacks that are used for evil, like, you know, or used for somebody's profit. But what about the behaviors that come from something that ordinarily would be healthy, like somebody on Stack Overflow who gets, you know, addicted or, you know, doesn't do their job because they're just hooked on Stack Overflow? I mean, has that actually come up in your guys' sites? Have there been people who have been like, I have to disconnect from Stack Overflow because I am actually addicted to this thing? Something that it would ordinarily be a good thing that you're using the site, but it's just, you know, ends up being abusive for them.
It does, but nothing really bad happens. What happens is people just tend to walk away. They get burned out and then they kind of walk away and may or may not come back, which is kind of a net loss to the community because a lot of these people that get really involved in Stack Overflow and some of the Stack Exchange sites are quite good. And the reason they're there is because they get all these positive feedback loops because they are good, right? All their stuff gets upvoted because it's amazing. And I worry that this will happen to stuff like, you know, Eric Lippert or other, you know, John Skeet or really, really high powered contributors. And I think, first of all, it's a personality thing. I mean, like John Skeet was on Usenet helping people long before Stack Overflow. You know, we just built a better Skinner box than they did, right? Like John Skeet is going to help people no matter where you put him. You could put him in front of a typewriter and an abacus and he would start helping people with it. So it's not a problem there, but for the people that sort of are drawn in by the model, and are quite good, it's disappointing when they eventually have to walk away. It's almost like you could wish you could say, well, whoa, slow down. And we do have stuff like the daily reputation limit, which people complain about, but it's there for your protection that you can only get 200 reputation in a day from normal upvoting. You can get more reputation through bounties and, you know, accepted answer and stuff like that. So there is another level to that game, if you will, of 200 plus rep. There's people that get thousands of reputation per week. They're clobbering the daily limit, like, you know, way beyond what normal people could do. But it is a net loss in the community when they can't pace themselves and burn out and walk away forever. It's like the whole take your ball and go home. And they're doing it for the right reason because they get burned out. You know, I don't mean to be negative in the way that I'm saying that. And sometimes it's for their own protection because we also have a lot of people in Stack Overflow that, and this is one of our biggest challenges, frankly, that are not giving at all in proportion to what they're getting. In other words, they post a one sentence description of something that they want and they get like a 20 line program written by somebody who spent 40 years of their life perfecting, you know, C code, right?
Mm-hmm.
Highly disproportionate amount of effort. And it's something that I personally frown on. I mean, Joel is more tolerant of it than I am, but I frown on that. Like, I don't want people to tolerate that because it's teaching you that you can do nothing and get everything in return. So as long as people are putting some amount of effort into the questions that they're asking and, you know, meeting us not even halfway, but like say a third of the way or 25% of the way, in the effort that they put into the question and their attempt to solve the problem and explain the problem, then that's fine. But they get burned out by the fact that a lot of newbies come on, don't put a lot of effort into their questions and get massively disproportionate help in return, you know, five answers to this thing that's been, say, a duplicate question that's been asked 50 times already, right? But it's a hard problem because we've built a system that's almost too good because simple questions are easy to answer, and that's why they attract so many answers, and also often very, very good answers. Like that thing that we discussed on the podcast about Eric Lippert, this great answer about, you know, pointer safety in C, which is as basic as it gets for C. It's like you dereference memory, but I can still see the data. What's going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, well... This is like C101. Just because you dereference the pointer doesn't mean, you know, what was in memory went away. It may or may not be there. You don't know. But that had been asked before many, many times and actually had good answers. But nobody said, hey, this is a duplicate. Close it as a duplicate, this other thing. Instead, Eric Lippert happened to see it, came in and gave this really kick-ass answer that everybody loved and became the new canon for that question. And it's debatable whether this is right or wrong or should or should not have happened. But the point is that you can come on Stack Overflow right now and ask, you know, this memory dereferencing question again. And in all honesty, what's going to happen is somebody's going to answer it really well.
Mm-hmm.
And what should happen is it should get closed as a duplicate of the Eric Lippert or the previous canon on the topic, because it's more effort to close as duplicate than it is to answer. And also the reputation system incentivizes simple questions getting great answers. And that's not wrong, right? That's what we built the system to do. You ask a simple question, you get a fantastic answer. So this is all side effects of the system that we've built. So it's tricky. But if people get burned out because they're seeing the same question over and over, I feel responsible, right? Like, I feel like we have failed you because our system has not protected you from people that are not doing the work, that are not researching this, you know, why do I dereference a pointer in C and the data is still there in memory? Why couldn't they find the answer to this question before they had to felt compelled to go on Stack Overflow, click ask a question, and ask it for the 50,000th time? So we're still improving the game ultimately. So to the extent that the game is not working and causing people to burn out, I feel responsible to some degree.
In a way, it's some of that, you know, related to games is kind of like the whole cheat code thing with games. You know, it's you get stuck on a level and it's easy enough to cop out and, you know, or watch a walkthrough or that kind of thing. And, you know, there's plenty of sites around that with tons of ads and
Well, right. This is the dark side of gamification. Of if you built a site that's for helping people with homework problems, well, how are you making money? Well, one, you could charge money for people to ask. But you really, the incentives are weird, you know? I mean, you almost have to have the nonprofit mentality. I like to say that with Stack Exchange, we try to have we're a for-profit company, obviously, to be clear. We're venture capital backed, but we like to really have a nonprofit mentality, or at the very least, maybe a public utility mentality. You know, we're trying to build something that's a public utility, so we have to hold it to a little bit higher standard than your average commercial website that's just out to, you know, make ends meet and not piss off too many people. We have to actively strive. You know how Google says, don't be evil? Well, I think our mantra is more like actively try to be good. Don't try to be evil. That's kind of a cop-out if you really think about it. It's like, okay, we can do this as long as it's not evil. As long as it's not evil, we can do it. You know, okay. It's not evil. It's kind of marginal, but it's not evil. It's like, well, try to do the absolute right thing. Try to do the best possible thing. And not the laziest thing. I mean, you know, not help everybody that needs help, even if they haven't, you know, contributed the appropriate amount of effort to being helped.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, help people understand that they need to put in the effort if they're going to show up, you know, on campus. You know, you have to do the homework and you have to show us that you show us your work. So, you know, it's participatory in that sense. I mean, it has to be. Otherwise, again, we'll be alienating the very people that are doing the most work in the system, providing all the answers. And this, to me, is a very much a game design problem.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like, how do you design the game to address that issue? And like for now, for example, I'm playing a lot of Battlefield 3. And one of the cool things about Battlefield 3 is it was one of the first games to have this really strong class-based multiplayer where you would be playing a certain role, say medic. So you're good at certain things, but you have weaknesses. You know, you're not like a one-man army. If a tank rolls in, you're really screwed as a medic because you can't do anything about that. Like, you just kind of have to run away or, you know, hope and pray that the tank doesn't see you. But hey, if you're a medic playing with an engineer, wow, all of a sudden the engineer can fight the tank with his rockets and stuff, and the medic can heal the engineer. You know, now all of a sudden you're this really potent force, and that amplifies. Like, say you're actually communicating on Skype like we are now while you're playing. Well, all of a sudden, you have this incredible level of teamwork and visibility onto the battlefield that people playing as singletons just don't have. So it's sort of encouraging you to play with other people to solve this problem. And it does that by giving you weaknesses, right? I mean, think about this. And this is where I think Joel has problems because he's not able to let people have the weaknesses. He wants to fix everything. But without those weaknesses, without saying, look, you can do certain things, but you can't do certain things, right? Without taking stuff away, you can't actually cause this to happen. And that's, I think, one of the lessons of Battlefield is how rewarding it can be if you're willing to say, you know, if you're going to say, oh, this sucks, there's a tank and now I'm screwed. Well, that's life, man. I mean, occasionally you're going to encounter tanks in life that you can't do anything about, right? You can do literally nothing to change this yourself. But by reaching out and playing with others and figuring out approaches, you can then solve this problem and take on this tank in your life, whatever the hell that is. And, you know, again, just teamwork. And maybe that's the World of Warcraft argument as well. Of, you know, like, how do you figure out how to solve these problems with other people?
That reminds me, and I forget the name of it, which takes a lot of the makes me sound really stupid. But the thing in Half-Life 2, they've got the whole problem solving thing where you've got the medic and the engineer and the gunner and all. What's that one called? It's.
Oh, Team Fortress?
Team Fortress, yeah. And that's great. I mean, that's probably the first like multiplayer thing like that I've played where it's like you've got a bunch of people, you know, if we were playing it on the LAN, but it was great. You know, you get all these people, hey, you do this, cover this door, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And the formulation of the rules encourages people to work together. And I think too many games started out with this adversarial mindset. And people don't really like conflict, I don't think, at some level. They like actually cooperating.
Mm-hmm.
And putting them in situations where there's a leaderboard and, you know, only one person can dominate is limiting. I think it's more appropriate to human nature that you say, okay, you know, if you attack this together, you can all have, you know, an equivalently high score as a team and we'll solve this problem together versus, you know, every man for himself kind of thing. Because that's pretty much, I mean, multiplayer gaming outside of, I guess, you know, two joysticks or whatever in front of the same television. But internet multiplayer is a very recent phenomenon in gaming. So I think they're still figuring out how it works, as are we.
Hmm. An interesting one I've played lately and I just got started with, but it's Portal 2, and the whole Portal 2 co-op mode is pretty interesting because it's completely puzzle solving. You're not shooting anybody, you know, you're just go through a maze, but you're having to solve things where the other player cannot progress until you open a door for them, and then they need to shoot a hole somewhere so you can go through it. I think that takes it to a whole, you know, to an even further level where you're not just cooperating, but you're, I don't know, you're solving the puzzle together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I haven't actually played that, but I've heard really good things about it. And Battlefield 3 has co-op levels. That it's another part of the game where you sort of sync with another player on the internet, and then it's just you two against essentially the computer. You know, this puzzle of, like, how do I survive this thing that's happening with this other person helping me? How can we work together to get through this? And to a lot of people, I think that's actually more fun than, you know, the pure adversarial modes. There's nothing really wrong with that, but co-op, it's good stuff. Again, and usually the computer is the enemy.
Yeah.
I think they call them comp stomps a lot of times. Like in StarCraft, they'll do that. It's like three of us against one hard computer AI.
The boss. We got a Kinect recently, and we've been having a lot of fun with that. Like, we've had an Xbox for a while, but we didn't really use it because it was too complicated for the kids to figure out the controllers and. If I'm going to play a computer game, usually I prefer to play, like, I'm used to a keyboard. I'm good at a keyboard, and controllers just piss me off, you know? And, so, like, but Kinect, I've been having tons of fun with, and, you know, the kids and I will do this Dance Central game, and, like, it's fun. And especially Dance Central 2, which just came out, they've got this co-op mode. And so, you know, they've got the dance battle, but they've also got, you're both dancing at the same time. And it is fun, you know, especially with kids, but it's fun to go through a level and be like, man. And another thing that they do right on this one is they give you just a bizarre amount of points. So, like, you finish a level and you're like, wow, we got 9 million points in 3 minutes, you know, and they just throw points at you.
Yeah, Dance Central is great. And Dance Central 2 is officially out now, so you can actually talk about it. In fact, I just got my copy finally today.
So my favorite difficult level, at least in the ones that I got to play with earlier, was Run, which is Gnarls Barkley, and that it's energetic. It's fun.
Yeah, Dance Central is great. I mean, it's kind of the poster child Kinect game for me. Plus, it's Harmonix, the same developers who made Rock Band, so I'm biased.
Hmm.
It's amazing to me how they can, like, I mean, it's another, like we were talking earlier about the guitar, and you're like, I in a way, I can't believe they can do it this well. And, like, for me, I cannot believe, like, me and my one kid are, like, dancing around in a room with a bunch of furniture, and my other kid runs through in front of us, and, like, it all still works, you know? And, like, it's in time, and I don't know, it's just, it's pretty amazing.
Indeed. But, you know, gaming, I wish the world was more like a game. And the other weird insight I had was I've been participating on this one forum for a long time, gosh, over 10 years now. And it did strike me at a couple points that, like, actually being on the forum and participating was in some level more fun than the games I was. It's a gaming forum, so we were talking about games. But at some level, this was actually more fun and more durable than the games I was actually playing. This idea that I was on this forum talking about these games with other people was in itself kind of a game that was kind of more fun than the games I was playing.
Inception.
Yeah, I know. And that was one of the things that actually led me to Stack Overflow, was this idea that, you know, being part of these communities can be overtly a game, and that's okay, as long as you're getting something out of it. And usually when you're participating with a lot of smart people, the odds of that are high, even if it is random discussion.
So you're mostly a console player, Jeff?
Oh, no. Mostly no. PC. Okay. I have console for Rock Band and Dance Central. I don't play very much on the Xbox 360 at all. And Rocksmith, of course. Although Rocksmith, I should point out, is actually coming out for PC in December.
Oh.
So you could have done that, Kevin, if you were willing to wait.
That's true. But I wanted to play it. I have a projector room. I wanted to play it on the projector. I don't have a PC down there.
There's some cool stuff on the Xbox 360, even if you're not a super hardcore gamer. It's a lot of fun stuff. And Kinect. Do you have the Kinect, Kevin?
Yes, I do. But
yeah, that is pretty awesome. I mean, it's kind of like what the Wii was supposed to be. Like, I remember my first time actually seeing the Wii and actually trying it. I was like, this is so lame. Like, I was promised, like, motions would control the game. And what the Wii is, without all the Motion Plus and all this other crap they added later, it's basically, it's an infrared mouse pointer on the screen. I was like, wow, what a letdown.
I mean, it was a big change at the time. It moved quite a bit in that you're, like, moving something as opposed to just clicking around. But I agree. And you know what? It's funny. I played the first time, like, with my you know, nephews and nieces and kids that play a lot of Wii and are good at it, and then they'll play Xbox, and I'll notice they kind of are, like, trying to cheat. Like, they're used to, with the Wii, just being able to kind of flick their wrist, and that's enough. Like, that's, you just slam the tennis, you know, racket or whatever, and by, like, flipping your wrist over, and it's like, no, you actually need to move your arm, you know?
Well, right, because it was totally fake. I mean, that's what struck me about the Wii was, I'm sure, given the constraints that they had, and it's not like it's a bad product, but based on what I had heard about and how much people were, like, blown away by it, my expectations were really high, and it was kind of a letdown by the time, because I didn't see the Wii until, like, years after it came out, actually touch one and try it, and I was like, wow, this is lame, frankly. But Kinect is literally what the Wii was supposed to be. It's kind of magical. Like, it's actually seeing you and detecting what you're doing. When it's working, it's magical. The only thing I don't like about Kinect is it really takes a ton of space. Like, unless you have, like, 8 feet in front of your television, you're kind of hosed, frankly. The space constraints are the only thing I warn people about on Kinect. It's like, it's substantial.
Yeah.
But I do think everybody that is interested in gaming at all should try and see the Kinect, because it's kind of the real deal as far as, you know, motion and stuff like that. And there's been so many, like, hacker things around it with all the dev kits and stuff that went out, that it's just neat technology. So be anxious to see where that goes and what finally happens with that.
How was that when I saw the Kinect? It's like, it's such cool technology. It almost seems like it's a waste on video games. You know what I mean? It's like, couldn't they do something way cooler with this than make video games? Like, you know, self-driving cars, or, you know, maybe that's just me.
No, it's true. It's kind of magical. It's like, it's truly a little bit magical, which the Wii was not for me at all. So yeah, anybody who hasn't seen it by this point, please go out of your way to see it at some point.
I think it's interesting how it can apply gamification to daily exercise.
There's a site that's doing that. I can't remember the name of it. I had to do a beta invite to it. It's still in private beta. But yeah, exercise. And there are some Kinect exercise games, which I bought. And let me give you the classic example. I bought, played once, and then have not played since.
Which one did you get?
I got the one that was getting pretty good reviews, the Your Shape.
That's yourself. The one I got. Yep.
It is cool. And there's some games out there awesome. Like, one where you're punching blocks. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yep.
But you know what gets me, K-Scott? Well, first of all, I'm a lazy bastard. And second, it just takes time to boot up the Xbox, to get to the game to the right place. Like, this whole instant on thing, like with the iPad, like, the argument is laptops are, in my opinion, way better than the iPad. But the iPad does have one thing going for it, which is, like, it's on in 1 second, right? Mm-hmm. That counts for a lot. And, like, the Xbox takes a long-ass time to boot up now. Mine does, anyway. I don't know what they did to it, but it's, you know, mine, a while to boot up.
Mine boots up really fast, but the navigation is the one thing. And even with Kinect, and I think from what I've seen of, you know, the public preview, they've announced stuff, you know, is like that's getting better. But it's like the part of, you know, like, okay, you turn your Xbox on and you're at, like, a screen, okay, and now you have to, like, get your controller and click around, and then you go into the game, and now you wave to your Kinect and it detects you, and it is, it's kind of like, okay, it's not instant on, and some of that's like, and another thing that's frustrating with Xbox and specifically with Kinect is the navigation, and it's like every game has its own, like, selection gesture.
Oh,
so
God. Yeah, I know.
It drives me nuts. And so it's like, okay, in Dance Central, you hold your hand over an arrow and you swipe right to left. And then in other ones, you hover over something. And
I hate those hovers. Those make me crazy.
Yeah. And then Your Shape, it's like even kind of weirder. You hold your hand over one thing and then underneath it, another thing appears and you have to hover over that. And it, like, my kids cannot, like, my especially the four-year-old, forget it. So we have to go in, select everything, run out of the screen. She runs in and hopes that the computer doesn't, like, realize that the person has changed, because it's, like, just too hard to select stuff.
Yeah, well, that's where Microsoft kind of failed by not having good UI guidelines of and maybe they didn't know, but I personally find that the Dance Central way is like massively superior to every other way. And all the other games should just stop. And like,
yeah,
if they send you a game for approval and it uses that bullshit selection mechanism, it should be rejected. I mean, this is the whole thing with the App Store. It's like, well, companies are supposed to be protecting you from this stuff. And, you know, how do they do that? One, by having some sort of guidelines around UI so everybody's not doing some crazy thing that's different. And second, you know, quality. Like, of course, how do you measure quality? That's impossible, but just obvious, you know, wrongness, I guess. But it is unfortunate that it's just evolving. I don't think Microsoft really knew what the best selection mechanism was, to be honest.
Or like you're saying, even knew what they had, you know, when it was first, you know, invented. It was like, yeah, whatever. You guys do what you're doing with your game thing.
The only thing that I do think that Kinect is going to have an issue with, and this might not be a problem because I find that the best games on like iPhone games, you know, or iPod Touch or iPhone games, are the ones where the game was expressly designed for the UI, the touch UI, where it's a game concept that was created expressly for this idea of you would be touching a 3.5-inch or however it is diagonal screen. The worst games are the ones where, like, for example, Duke Nukem is the worst iPhone game I have ever played. It's just the controls are abysmal. The experience is terrible because it was designed for, you know, keyboard and mouse, or just at least keyboard. And it doesn't map over at all. Like, you have to build the game around the UI. You have to build the game around the interaction mechanism completely almost. And Kinect, I think, is the same way, where people came up, like this game that's getting really good reviews is the Gunstringer. Have you tried that, John?
I haven't. I've just seen videos of it.
It's supposed to be really, really good, but the whole game concept was designed around, you know, motion controls and not, you know, tacked on or baked on later. And I think that's the way you have to look at it. The only disappointment for me with Kinect is there is a limitation of there's no button, which... You know, again, there's no button on the iPhone and they get by, right? I mean, they have really good games. But it is a disappointment for me as a shooter fan. Like, it would be cool to have, like, a virtual gun that I'm aiming with mice for my hands. But how do you fire? Like, what's the trigger? Yeah. Like, what do you do? You're going to wave every time you want to fire? Are you going to... That doesn't really work. I guess you could have some sort of IR sensor, like, on the gun that would light up in IR that in some way that the Kinect could see. That's That'd probably what they'd have to do.
Yeah.
But that's something you'd have to buy. It's not a built-in, you know, it would be an add-on type of thing, which those typically don't do well.
Yeah. One other thing is it does have a pretty good microphone built in, too.
That's true.
So maybe, I mean, it would be dumb to yell fire, but I mean, you know. Wow.
Bang, bang.
Yeah.
That would be really.
Pew, pew. Really
yeah. Pew, pew. That's awesome.
There you go.
Okay. I want you to get an Xbox dev kit, and I want pew, pew to be released. Kinect, pew, pew. Kevin Dente's Kinect Pew Pew. Because you got to put the name in there, like Sid Meier's Civilization. Because Kevin Dente, that's a huge name in the industry, as well it should be.
Yep. Well, I was thinking, it's been a while. We should probably wrap up soon. We did get some questions over Twitter. Was there anything you wanted to go over first or that we missed that was big picture?
No, I think that was a good survey.
A good effort by all. So we got some good questions over Twitter. We got a few asking about your favorite old-timey games. Bill Reese asked about your favorite TI-99 game besides Hunt the Wumpus. And then we also heard from Maliok, who I believe is Eric Sowell, and he asked, what was your favorite Atari 2600 game and why?
Man, you know, in retrospect, I think most of the Atari 2600 games were really quite bad. It pains me to say this. But, you know, there's this romanticism of sentimental. And if you actually go back and play those games, I got to tell you, they were really not that good. And they were just the best you could do with what we had at the time. I think the one that disappointed me least was Yar's Revenge. For whatever reason, like Yar's Revenge, there was something like abstract art about Yar's Revenge that appealed to me as a kid. Like I would point to that as the one sort of maybe game that has a shred of hope for being interesting when you play it today.
Does that go for TI-99 as well, Hunt the Wumpus?
TI-99, you know, I had a bunch of games that I liked. I used to play Parsec a lot, but it was just really a clone. That was like a clone of like Defender, basically, not a very good one. But I enjoyed it. It was good. And then there was Munchman again, you know, a clone of Pac-Man. There's nothing really sacred about gaming. To me, the gaming is about the next great thing. And that's why I love Battlefield 3, because Battlefield 3, I mean, first of all, it's a completely next generation graphics engine that is amazing. It does like deferred lighting and like it does all this. It looks like realistic. I mean, it looks like you're really there. And the sound in the game is, oh my God, it's unbelievable. It's like the best sound I've ever heard in a video game. It's astonishingly good. And the experience, the overall experience is like, you know, immersion, you know, and you're just not going to get that out of an Atari 2600.
Yeah.
Regardless of, you know, and to me, every time I played a game, it was a fantasy. It was a fantasy of, oh, look, I'm in this place. I'm driving a tank and it's like five friggin' blocks on the screen. Well, now I'm driving a tank and my God, I'm in the desert. There's these huge plumes of smoke in the distance and, you know, things are vibrating, things are shaking. I can hear every rumble on the battlefield and it's incredible. So, you know, I got to tell people, give up a little bit on the romanticism and really look at like current games and demand that they move forward, not just, you know, in terms of better pew, 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 but a better experience. You know, war is not a great experience, right? And I had this argument on Twitter about, you know, am I glorifying war? I don't really mean to be. But one of the interesting exchanges I had was with a guy. He eventually said, you know what, I think you're right. I think the best games would illustrate that war is not fun, you know? And I think Battlefield does that because it's fucking terrifying, right? Like, you're getting shot at, and it, like, the things that are happening are, like, incredibly chaotic. Yeah. And no one in his right mind would do this in real life. Like, I'm not going to go, wow, I really want to go drive a tank and shoot at people because, like, my God,
yeah,
I would be crapping my pants, you know?
So, the last one I played like that was Medal of Honor, and it was that same. It had that kind of similar to the beginning of Band of Brothers, where you've got to get up, you know, the beaches of Normandy. And I had, like, I just playing it with headphones on, and the graphics not near as good and all, but the storyline of that really pulled me in.
Yeah, they do some cool stuff, and you know, no, again, nobody would. It's Saving Private Ryan. I mean, and the other thing that struck me is like, would you rather spend 2 hours watching a movie, which is passive,
mm-hmm.
or 2 hours participating in a movie where you're the lead actor? That to me is sort of the Battlefield story. Assuming you want to see a war movie. Now, if you want to see a drama, you're in trouble, or a comedy, mm-hmm. it's a different experience. But I struggle with that because I have, for example, the new. X-Men movie. I have that. And I haven't gotten around to watching it because every time I've sat down, it's like, I have an hour and a half to do something. Do I want to be the lead actor in the movie or do I want to passively watch other people act? And it's kind of a tough call.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, you got to think this is the future of entertainment. I mean, it's only going to get better, like more immersive, more incredible. I mean, there's almost this big disconnect between how good entertainment is and kind of how boring work and education are.
Yeah.
I mean, how many billions of dollars are we pouring into making entertainment incredible? Versus how many billions of dollars are going into making education incredible?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big disconnect. So it's tough. And that's why, again, this gamification stuff, it sounds silly, but like mm-hmm. we kind of need to do it because otherwise there's this discontinuity in how great things can be.
I wonder if we should wrap up there. I wanted to ask about any other favorite games you wanted to just mention, but I don't know if that's kind of...
I kind of told people they shouldn't have a favorite game.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, I have been kind of a fan of the classic arcade game, like, emulator scene, you know, the MAME scene. Do you guys ever dabble in that stuff?
Yeah.
Not the Atari 2600. I have no romantic memories right. about the Atari 2600. It was pretty much crap.
We had a Twitter question about that reminded me of that, Jeff. Justin Angel asked about building your own arcade machine, and you did that a while ago, at least more than once?
Twice. Once for Vertigo and once for myself.
Do you still play that much anymore? I mean, is it...
Well, that's the other observation is again, given a fixed pool of time, assuming you're going to die eventually, you don't have an unlimited time, would you rather spend right. time on sort of the latest and greatest, like most amazing games, or looking at the old stuff? And the old stuff is interesting, like, but I feel like that's something you do once and then you're done. You're like, okay, I've done that. I looked at that. It was cool. It was very cool, to be honest. And I love revisiting it, but I want to live in the now and the future. I don't want to continually revisit the past. So, but I do like it. And, you know, I obviously grew up with all those games and I love them. Don't get me wrong. The nicer arcade games. But arcades are kind of going away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's the way it should be. You know, every house is an arcade now. I mean, how great is that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, for not much money, you can have an experience that they would have, you know, paid unbelievable amounts of money from. That was impossible to have in 1985 or
yeah.
whatever. And now it's just like every day in routine. We take that kind of for granted.
So I have one other question with this is just I played a game recently, Braid, which was, you know, definitely retro style graphics. It was not, you know, the graphics were not going to win any. Well, the graphics were cool, but, you know, not fancy.
Right.
But the the premise of the game is that you can go back in time, and you can, and there's places where you have to solve the game by getting to a certain place and then going back in time and changing things. And it's not like a little gimmick. It's fundamental to the game, and it made me think differently. Like, it actually, to the point where I was, you know, reading different books and fiction. And, you know, I mean, do you have any games like that, that like are fundamental and, or so interesting in the approach, that they're not getting your attention by graphics or the immersive thing, but more by how they're innovative ideas, I guess?
A lot of the indie games are like that, where they don't have a budget to build. I mean, games are really hard to build now, as I pointed out earlier in the call, that it's not 5 pixels make up a running guy. It's like, okay, you need thousands of megabytes of textures, meshes, just for one guy. So yeah, they start with the simpler concepts, like, okay, let's take a Mario game, which is what Braid is riffing on, this jumping kind of game, and put this high art box around it. And then, and really interesting, you know, commentary, really interesting, you know, take the mechanics, like going back in time, not just the story, but also tweaking the mechanics to sort of take it to the next level. Mm-hmm. So I definitely appreciate them, but I personally could not really get into Braid. I honestly have never really liked Mario-type games, and the mechanics really don't do it for me. But I love indie gaming, and I think it's something we want to encourage, something we want to, you know, keep growing, because games need to permeate many, many layers of society, particularly the jobs and education side that we talked about. And anything that gets people engaged and thinking in the way of how can we make this enjoyable is definitely the right way to go. I'm trying to think of another example of an indie game that I actually really liked. It's tough.
I mean, I mentioned World of Goo before. I think we talked about that one.
I love World of Goo. Fantastic game. I wrote a blog entry about World of Goo. So yeah, huge fan of World of Goo. And also physics games I find very, very enjoyable. And World of Goo is basically a physics game, in my opinion, where, you know, you just have sort of this contraption, and you have these basic rules, and it's in 2D, so it's not too hard to manage, right? Not 3D rules are incredibly complicated. And you just have to, you have some goal, and you have to use the physics and what you have to reach that goal, which I think is fun. It gives you a lot of options, which is fun as a game player. And I guess for Braid, the example is, you know, the time travel angle is giving you options. You know, it's not just that you have to be able to jump from platform A to platform B, but how can you use time as a tool to help you achieve this goal, to get from point A to point B?
One other thing that I thought was neat with Braid was that, you know, you get to the end, you solve all the puzzles. That's pretty cool. And then you find, I went and looked up, and I found out that there's these 6 stars that you can get. And each of them is like, there's no way you would know. I don't know how anyone figured this out, but they're like, they're all complete Easter eggs. You jump into this area and all of a sudden you're in a complete new area. And one of them, you have to stand on this thing, and to get this other star, you have to wait 1.5 hours.
Wow.
It's pretty interesting. If you look, there's YouTube where they speed through it, and they're just all 6 stars. But then you get through, and it's a whole new thing. And I like the ability to like solve the game at one level, satisfying. You're not missing out on anything. But then there's this whole like level that's just like you're saying, the difference between Rock Band and Rocksmith. It's just like, holy cow! Like, I don't even know how anyone would have the dexterity or patience to do any of that stuff.
But that's good game design. For the people that are really engaged with the game, like a lot of the stuff we have on Stack Overflow, the average user is never, ever going to be able to get. But it's absolutely critical to have that in there, because the people who are really engaged kind of need something else to strive for, you know? And it's something, again, that's helping them and helping the community, but there needs to be, they're playing at a different level, right? Than the sort of casual gamers. And building a game that works for all those levels that's, again, good game design. And we actually did have some academic studies done with the Stack Overflow data set. And one of the things they found was that there was a big drop off. Once you got to what was the previous highest reputation level, which unlocked certain abilities, there was a drop off of participation. People reached 10,000 rep. There's now a 20,000 rep ability, partly because of this, and also because we needed it for maintaining the system, that they did tend to sort of fall off at that point once you reached the goal. And I got to tell you the power. Let me end with this one analogy. So we're playing Battlefield 3 a lot right now, and actually I'm going to play it right after this call, and I'm really looking forward to it actually. But there's so many ways to level up, and they always show you that progress bar. Like, here's the next thing you're going to get. And if that bar is more than halfway across, it's so tempting to look at that and say, if I just play one more time, I could just, you know, and on several levels, like per weapon, per kit, per soldier, there's like on my screen right now, I'm looking at like literally six progress bars, and some of them are so close. You know, and I think that's great. And I think it's human nature to want to do this stuff and want to level up. And it's our responsibility as a culture, as game designers, as participants, to demand that the games where we're spending our time, we're getting some kind of return for that. Even if it's just, you know, little things like with Kinect, for example, you're getting physically fit because you have to move your hand rather than making the ping pong gesture with a mouse swipe on the Wii. You have to raise your hand up and swing it down, right? Well, hey, at least you are exercising, right? You're getting that out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not everything has to be the cure for cancer. Just make sure you're getting something out of the games you're playing and try to design games that give people something. That's kind of the way I look at it.
By the way, speaking of leveling up, congratulations on your big announcement.
Oh, yeah, the twin girls.
Pending arrival of twins.
Yep. Dual lady.
Multi-ball play.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited, but also scared.
It'll be busy.
What we need is the child simulation game to teach people how this works. I don't think anyone would want to play that.
Hopefully it's not The Sims, because if my success with my kids was anything like when I was playing Sims, they would not be alive.
They will be dead in a pool of their own urine.
Exactly.
Very, very soon, just like on The Sims. Right. You know, we joke about that, but I actually know for a fact there's several games involving babies targeted towards, you know, teenage girls and things like that, but there actually are those games that I was joking about.
How is Babby formed?
Yep, the How Is Babby Formed game.
Yep.
It's out there.
All right, well, we should wrap up there. This is awesome. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it.
Cool. And now I have to get a new video card so I can play Battlefield 3 now.
Yeah, that was kind of the stumbling block. I saw which video card you had. And I was like,
That's always my problem.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's a lot of good options right now.
I'd say the graphics cards are a treadmill.
Well, the Bitcoin miners are dumping massive amounts of video cards on eBay. You should go there.
Oh, good.
Because Bitcoin mining is dead. Because Bitcoin is kind of dead.
It's an interesting thing.
I will send you some links.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. Jeff is off to play Battlefield 3, and I suggest you do too.
That's right. I'll see you on the battlefield.
Okay. Bye, Jeff.
Bye, guys.